Welcome to the Civil Engineering Podcast, the podcast focused on helping civil engineering professionals succeed by exposing them to interesting civil engineering projects and successful civil engineering professionals around the world. Hosts Anthony Fasano and Christian Knutson had successful but unconventional civil engineering careers and now focus on helping civil engineering professionals achieve their goals in work and life.
Welcome to the Civil Engineering Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Fasano, and this is the podcast specifically for civil engineering professionals who want to succeed. In today's episode, I talk to the one and only Sam Schwartz, president and CEO of Sam Schwartz Consulting, a firm that specializes in transportation planning and engineering. He's also known as Gridlock Sam, which we'll talk a little bit about later on. We really get into Sam's career journey in this episode, which is really interesting. I mean, he went from a taxi driver to a top traffic consultant. We also covered some other very interesting topics like driverless cars, which is the topic of Sam's forthcoming book. And this was an in-person interview. I went down to Sam's office in New York City and I sat with him in his conference room. And he was very open about his entire career, which has been a very lengthy and very successful and accomplished career. And for me, it was also a special interview because I grew up in the New York City metro area. And if you have, you probably heard of Gridlock Sam or these Gridlock Sam alerts. And so he tells us the whole story behind Gridlock Sam, which is something that he still participates in. He still does. He still puts these alerts out there. And again, that's part of him building his authority, which we also get into. So it's a really, really informative interview. I think you can find a lot of value in it in terms of building expertise throughout your career like Sam has done, and I'm excited to share it with you. Before we get into the main segment of our show, I want to recognize our sponsor for this episode, PPI, by reminding you to please stick around until the end of this podcast for my essential career advancement tips. I'll be sharing info where to find practical advice and the best resources for your licensure exam, including an exclusive 20% discount available only to our listeners, thanks to our sponsor, PPI. You won't want to miss it. I also want to say that we are in the process here of a 5-episode series on infrastructure on the podcast, which is happening in addition to our regular every other Wednesday episodes. So you'll see about 5 episodes sprinkled in. Our first one was the last episode, number 84, where I interviewed Christina Swallow, the current ASCE president, about infrastructure, specifically building sustainable, meaningful infrastructure. But we're going to continue this series. We've got some really interesting topics. So just keep listening to the podcast and you'll see those episodes pop into your iTunes feed. All right, now I'd like to introduce our guest for today's civil engineering conversation. Sam Schwartz, also known as Gridlock Sam, is the president, as I said earlier, of Sam Schwartz Consulting, a firm that specializes in transportation planning and engineering. He also writes columns on traffic for the New York Daily News and the New York Downtown Express. Previously, Mr. Schwartz was New York City's traffic commissioner and was the chief engineer of the New York City Department of Transportation. He started his transportation career in the late 1960s as a New York City cabbie and joined the traffic department as a junior engineer in 1971. Sam has received more than a score of awards for his work, including the 2016 New York City Zoning Advisory Council Honor Award, 2014 AAA Traffic Safety Award, 2014 Brooklyn Technical High School Distinguished Alumni Award, and a whole host more. He obtained his Bachelor of Science degree in Physics at Brooklyn College and received a Master of Science degree in Civil Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania. He is a licensed professional engineer in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Florida. All right, let's jump into today's civil engineering conversation.
Civil Engineering Podcast.
Civil Engineering Podcast.
All right, now it's time for our civil engineering conversation. And today I'm happy to welcome Sam Schwartz. Sam is the CEO of Sam Schwartz, a company that offers comprehensive traffic and transportation planning, engineering, and design services to public and private sector clients all over the world. But Sam is also many other things that we're going to dive into with him. Sam, welcome to the Civil Engineering Podcast.
Thank you very much.
So, Sam, you've done so much in your career, and we're going to dive into a lot of these things. I read your bio earlier for our listeners, but to start off, I'd like to just ask you in your own words, how would you describe yourself?
Okay, well, being a CEO of a company means you're everything.
Okay.
You're a salesperson, got to go out and find the money. You've got to do the marketing of it. You have to make sure you deliver the product. You have to make sure people know about your firm, especially when you're relatively small. We're about 125 people, which at one time was a mid-sized firm, but today we have firms of 10,000, even 100,000 people. So it's pretty tough to compete in a market like that. One of the things that we focus on is getting our name out there. So we write a good deal. I've got a couple of several books that I've written. I have a book coming out in a few months called No One at the Wheel. It's about driverless cars. I've written about cities, street smart. We do a great deal of media, from print media to television to radio. We make sure that we get our name out there. Otherwise, it's pretty hard for the smaller firms to get known.
So I definitely want to get into Gridlock, Sam, sooner rather than later. I'm from the area, my wife as well, and we're familiar with it. But before we go there, oftentimes in civil engineering, it's said that it's good to start in the field to get experience. Mm-hmm. And for me, I started in the field as a surveyor and went into site engineering. And for you, as a transportation engineer, you've got the ultimate field experience by starting out as a taxi driver. Tell us about that.
Now 50 years, 1968, I was driving a taxi cab while going to Brooklyn College. And I continued to do that after college. And then after graduate school, I had a period in which I couldn't find a job. So my job was being a New York City cab driver. And things were a lot different 50 years ago driving a cab. It was the cabs weren't well maintained. The cab drivers were viewed as kind of reckless, and we drove fast and we tried to get that customer, get rid of that customer. But one of the things that I always did, even before I became a cab driver, I loved to look at maps. I was a Brooklyn boy and I would look at every street in Brooklyn, find streets I never heard of and think about how to get there. And then expanding to Manhattan as a cab driver, you then have to get to know the whole city. But I mostly drove in Brooklyn and Manhattan.
Now, when you were driving a taxi, did you, at that time, you didn't know you were getting into civil engineering or transportation engineering yet, did you?
I was studying to be a physicist. I came from immigrant parents who fled between world wars. They fled from Poland, and they had virtually no education. My father, I think, may have gone to the third grade. My mother, out of a very large family, had 1 year of high school, but they vowed that their kids would all go to college, and they achieved that. So the only person I knew on a personal level who went to college was my older brother, Brian, and he was had a PhD in physics. He was at MIT at the time when I was going to Brooklyn College, and so I thought that would be my life because I didn't know anything else. So at 20 years old, I was started to be recruited by lots of what I'd call the B schools in physics to get a PhD in physics. And I went to visit my brother to get some advice. And I was 20 years old. And he said, why do you want to become a physicist? He said, you're 20 years old. You haven't been discovered yet. At best, you're going to be a mediocre physicist. You're going to spend 7-8 years getting your PhD. You're going to come out and work at some obscure university on the spin of the 26th electron of a copper atom. Is that what you really want to do with your life? And he said, what do you like to do? And I was a dumb 20-year-old. I said, I don't know. Ultimately, we got to cities because I really resented the suburbs. I resented L.A. for taking my Dodges. The suburbs took all my siblings, all my friends. I was a Brooklyn kid who was kind of left alone. Everybody was abandoning. So I said, I like cities. And he thinks in equations. And he said, well, you're pretty good in science and math, not good enough to be a physicist. So science plus math plus cities, and he came up with equals traffic. And so I began looking at schools. I applied to where my brother was at MIT. I got accepted to MIT, but I didn't want to be that close to my brother. I ended up going to University of Pennsylvania, which had a very strong transportation program. I did that for a couple of years, got my master's degree, came back to New York City and landed a job with the New York City Traffic Department.
Right.
So I was that entry-level junior engineer who was assigned to do everything in traffic, from counting the cars to walking the sites to interviewing people to measuring locations, all of those things as a junior engineer. And over the years, worked my way up through the ranks, which was surprising. I stayed away from political clubhouses. I was never someone who supported elected officials other than, you know, as a citizen supporting things, but never expecting anything in return. And through the ranks, ultimately, I ended up getting an assistant commissionership, and that led to becoming traffic commissioner in 1982. And then literally when all my colleagues were arrested in a scandal in 1986, I was the sole person standing in the Department of Transportation, became the chief engineer, the first deputy commissioner of the agency. So I've kind of had an education, a multi-million dollar education that the city gave me. I was certainly was not a structural engineer or a bridge engineer, but I became Monsieur Pont, as Le Monde put me. I was in every engineering journal as the man responsible for New York City's bridges as they were collapsing. And they were literally collapsing in the New York metropolitan area. A lot of people forget. Yeah. 15 people died in bridge collapses in the New York metro area in the one decade of the 1980s. So it was my job to restore the bridges of New York City. And I had to do a lot of quick learning, which I did, and set in motion an excellent program, which I'm proud of today, that today's the bridges of New York City are stronger than they ever were. There were no more catastrophes after that. And I thought I was at the top of my game in 1990. Well, a new mayor came in and thought he wanted a new team. So I was given the boot, even though I was a career civil servant, I could have stayed. And it was a good move for me. I began teaching at Cooper Union. I was already teaching at LIU prior to that. I started at a company called Hayden Wegman. But also, I had done a lot of media, especially when, as bridges were collapsing, I was the center of press conferences. And believe me, the mayor didn't want to be there when it was bad news. So I was the guy, the media got to know me.
They sent you to the stage.
I was in the firing squad. And I had released the word gridlock in 1980.
Yeah, let's talk about this, because I think a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with gridlock, Sam, if they're not from the area. And like I said, my wife and I are, and I'm very familiar with. In fact, when I knew I was going to come interview you, I texted my wife. I said, I'm going to get to interview gridlock Sam. She laughed. So tell the story of what is gridlock, Sam? How did it come about? Please explain that.
In the 1970s, as I said, I was working for the traffic department, which ultimately got consumed by the Department of Transportation. But I was one of the traffic engineers. We talked about the grid system of Manhattan. We looked at various plans and talked about if we do this, this intersection may lock up soon, this next intersection and the whole grid would lock up. But nobody ever put it together as one word. Nobody ever wrote it down. And the reason I know that is I did research after it was released to see if there was somebody else I should share credit with. And in 1980, I was the architect of the city's response to the transit strike. In 1980, the subways, the buses, for the first few days, all the railroads went out, and I was the guy the mayor was relying on to manage the city. One of the things that I had written in the plan was something called a gridlock prevention program. But it was two words, gridlock prevention program.
Okay.
I didn't see it as one word, but as soon as the media heard about this thing called gridlock, I was suddenly front and center of press conferences. And what is gridlock? The year before, there was a word called meltdown, which was when a nuclear reactor had melted down at Three Mile Island. So people saw gridlock, meltdown. These are, you know, great eight-letter words.
Right.
And I had to try to explain what gridlock was and the science of a grid system locking up. But the word caught on like wildfire. There was an on-language column in the New York Times Magazine by William Sapphire, who was considered the linguist for America. And he called me and said, Sam, you got to find out the origin. And I asked all my colleagues. And they said, no, Sam, you're the one who uttered it first. I know I was the one that wrote it down. First, I was the one that spoke about it publicly, but I always share it with a fellow named Roy Cottam, another traffic engineer. But Roy was a very paranoid guy, and I think he was afraid he'd be blamed for it. So he said, Sam, you get all the credit. So gridlock has been associated with me since 1980. The word caught on. I started keeping a record, people, as they traveled around the country, the word. They would send me a clipping from a newspaper that used the word. God. Soon the word expanded to mean any kind of stalemate. Whenever the president of the United States and every president since 1980 has uttered the word gridlock. I get chills in my spine saying the president of the United States wouldn't be saying that if I didn't write that word down on it. So in 1990, I had a decade of tremendous amount of media coverage. And the one idea, again, my physicist brother came up with is, why don't you parlay that? You're always trying to predict the future of what's going to happen in traffic. I was always warning the public. And he said, why don't you become the equivalent of a weatherman for traffic, a traffic forecaster? So I pitched it to a couple of newspapers under the moniker Gridlock Sam. And several newspapers actually negotiated with me. I started writing for the New York Daily News in 1990. I'm still writing. 28 years later, I write a column on what's going to happen. I write, it comes out twice a week on a Friday as to what we can expect for the weekend traffic, what we can expect on and another one that comes out on Sunday for the week ahead. I write.
You're still doing this, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I write for the Downtown Express under the name The Transit Sam. I wrote for the Queens Chronicle, the Queens Traffic Guru, and I wrote for a Yiddish newspaper under the name Gridlock Shmuel. So I've written for a number of papers. I do a lot of radio, a lot of TV.
How would you characterize, is Gridlock Sam like an alert? Like when you write these articles, you're predicting traffic gridlock and...
Yeah, traffic, sometimes transit. Traffic does repeat itself to some extent. So every year I put out a Gridlock Sam calendar, and I could tell you which days the most parking tickets are written. I could tell you the days the most car crashes occur. In fact, there's April 20th, apparently, is Marijuana Day, and there's a spike in crashes because people use marijuana. Super Bowl Sunday is a very dangerous day to drive after the game, but it's worse for those people whose team loses. So there are so many predictive elements in traffic. We know the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, there'll be 5-mile jams at the George Washington Bridge at 5 o'clock. So we know when the Mets open, when they have their opening game, or if they're a contender, as they are this year, suddenly we'll have more traffic around the Mets games. Tied into when the president comes to New York, I know exactly. I can't say in the paper exactly, but I have my contacts in the police department. Mm-hmm. In one of my former lives, I was in charge of traffic enforcement, so I have very good contacts, and I will know the route. I won't give people the route, but I will tell them what to avoid. They can infer from that. I won't give exact times. And I know when there's going to be a demonstration, and I know when there's a world event, something happened, a bomb goes off in Afghanistan, it's a New York City traffic problem. There'll be people demonstrating in the streets.
I see.
If, sadly, a police officer is killed in the line of duty, it's a New York City traffic problem. I'll advise my readers to please show their respect by not driving in the area where the wake and the funeral will be. So I'm writing and telling people, like a weather forecaster says, what's the weather going to look like for the next 5 days? I do that for the weekend, say, here's what's going to happen in the weekend, here's what's going to happen next week, and I have over 12,000 Twitter followers who want to hear what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
So every single day we're tweeting, or if something happens today and there's a massive car crash, we'll be saying avoid the Major Deegan. If it turns out there's a structural problem, we'll be writing how to get around that structural problem.
Are there a certain designated gridlock days? Isn't it like if the president comes to New York, it's considered a gridlock alert or something? Is that?
Yes, it's kind of funny how gridlock alert days came about. I love statistics. I love math. And I was traffic commissioner in 1982. And I said, we've got to improve our ability to predict traffic. So I collected data in a crude way from every single toll facility in the city of New York. There are 9 Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority facilities, and then there are 6 Port Authority facilities, because I knew that's good data. If you're collecting money, the data is very good.
Sure.
And then I looked at every single day and put it in a crude spreadsheet. They were just developing things like that. Then I had it put in order as to what's the heaviest day of the year. And so I was able to see day number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, through 10 through 365.
Oh, wow.
I remember proudly showing this to a New York Times reporter who was interviewing me, and he asked a question that I hadn't thought ahead of, but luckily I made something up on the spot. He said, "This is great, Sam, you have all this data. Now, what are you going to do with the data?" And fortunately, I'm a quick thinker, and I said, "I'm going to declare the top 10 gridlock alert days." And that's the genesis of gridlock alert days. So whenever you hear a gridlock alert day, it has to do with the heavier traffic volumes or the president's coming to town. Or sometimes I'll talk about a gridlock alert for the borough of Brooklyn because there's a race through Brooklyn and major roads, Flatbush Avenue, Ocean Parkway, and others are all going to be closed. So I'm also the father of gridlock alert.
So there's set days, but then you add days to it if something happens.
Correct. Like
the president comes to town or something, which makes a lot of sense. Before we get into your company that you're building, because I want to talk about that experience, it seems like your brother is someone that you kind of go to throughout your career for, I don't know, advice or mentoring or thing to bounce off.
Yeah, I have two brothers and a sister. Both brothers, one is 10 years older than me, one's 12 years older than me. They've been my advisors throughout at various times. They've worked in my company when I started in 1995. My bookkeeper had a PhD in physics. That was my brother. And right now, my older brother, who's retired, handles a lot of the financial aspects, negotiates with the banks. He's a businessman. He was president of a number of companies. So I go to my brother's. My sister is a registered nurse, although she hasn't practiced for many years. So for her, if I have an ache and pain, I might go to her for advice.
I see. But you're always seeking some kind of advice from them. But
always reach out to people who may have been there before you and have learned a thing or two.
Yeah, it seems like that's been powerful. I want to read a couple sentences from your bio and ask you to comment on it because it stuck out to me. It's part where it says, "Mr. Schwartz specializes in creative problem solving for seemingly intractable situations. He's expert at getting people out of their cars and into other forms of transportation. He's also proficient at moving those people who remain in their cars more swiftly and safely. Mr. Schwartz has created many win-win-win situations whereby traffic moves better, pedestrians are safer, and the community gains more sidewalk and green space. He's been called an urban alchemist for making grass grow from asphalt." Why is this so important to you, movement?
Anybody that's really studied traffic, anybody that has worked as a traffic engineer in the city, especially in dense cities, knows the answer in the United States in particular, fewer vehicles. But we've been terribly unsuccessful in reducing the number of vehicles coming in. So throughout the United States, and I say the United States because in Europe they've been doing more things to get people out of cars, we've been doing far fewer. Traffic volumes have increased throughout the 20th century. We had a little dip for the Great Depression, a dip, of course, of World War II, and tiny dips in the 1970s for a fuel crisis. But largely, we traffic engineers have been unsuccessful getting people out of their cars. Around 2003, 2004, something happened that none of us planned on, expected, no professional I know could take credit for it, but traffic volumes started to go down in the United States for 10 straight years. I wrote a book on it, Street Smart, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars, but it's largely the millennial population that's driving a lot less. And they're driving not 2 or 3% less, they're driving 20 to 25% less. That's a very good sign. Now, people bring us in when they have a seemingly intractable traffic problem, and I can give you many examples. One is the Barclays Center. The Barclays Center hosts the Brooklyn Nets. I was so happy to see a Brooklyn professional sports team come back, and that was the location where the Brooklyn Dodgers should have been. If you go to my office, you'll see pictures of me with the Brooklyn Dodgers. I'm still hoping they return someday. But at least we got the Brooklyn Nets. Well, the Brooklyn Nets, the stadium, the Barclays Center, is at the corner of Flatbush Avenue, Atlantic Avenue, and 4th Avenue. Three major streets come together. Traffic nightmares were predicted. People were saying this is the worst possible location. Well, the Nets, the Barclays Center, Forest City Ratner, which was my client, brought me in and said, "Sam, You've got to get people out of their cars. If people are coming in cars, we're going to have gridlock, and we can't function with that. So I developed a plan among, you know, there are many aspects to it. There's already great transit. How do we popularize that transit? How do we let fans know about it? Ran a number of focus groups. And in the focus groups, we invited people likely to go to the arena, sports fans, but sports fans also that were hardcore drivers. And we went through a number of sessions. We offered them free Metro cards, the card that we use for transit in New York City. It didn't move the needle at all. We said, we'll get you pictures with players. Didn't matter. Free hamburgers, whatever. Nothing was moving the needle. And after the third or fourth focus group, one of the facilitators was getting frustrated. And he started to say to somebody, well, where do you live? And the person explained where in Queens he lived. And the facilitator said, did you know that there's a Long Island Railroad stop just four blocks from where you are, and it takes you right to the Flatbush Atlantic, right to the stadium? And I said, I didn't know that. And suddenly we realized one of the gaps, and we started doing this with other people, was that drivers no longer knew how to use transit. And so we embarked upon a campaign to educate fans that would be going to the arena. The end result is the Barclays Center has the lowest share of people driving, 26%, 27%, driving to any arena in the country, including Madison Square Garden. We did a lot of other traffic changes. Right. We improved some of the transit service. We built some underground tunnels and a whole host of other things. But we've been doing this throughout. We're reducing the number of people that come in by automobile, sometimes doubling up the people in automobiles, improving transit service, making biking easier, making functional activity easier. A lot of people don't know the term functional activity, but in the United States, we often have no activity unless we go to the gym. Whereas if we approach things differently and we walk to a subway station, we walk 2,000 steps. Yeah. We then walk upstairs. To me, the subway is my gym. Every single day, racing to the train, I'm going up and down staircases. I then have to walk from the train station. I put on 2-3 miles a day and 10 flights a day just in the normal course of my day. That's functional activity. Sometimes I do bike to work. That's functional activity. Americans have forgotten about it. So we're trying to get people back into functional activity. Why? Because inactivity now kills more people than car crashes. Mm. Kills four times as many people as car crashes. So getting people out of their cars has health benefits to it, environmental benefits to it, allows cities to function better, allows cities to have more, and that's the grass growing from asphalt, yes. The alchemy. It allows us to say we don't need as much space for the automobile, that we can build parks where automobiles used to be. One of the things I'm proudest of are two parks in Lower Manhattan. Lower Manhattan, the densest part in the United States, the financial district.
Yeah.
I added 3/4 of an acre of parkland to Battery Park, right just in the financial district area, and the traffic actually moved better. Did the same thing in Canal Street by the West Side Highway, where I discovered a park that had been there from the 1880s to 1920, and it was this Samuel Parsons, a famous architect, and Calvert Volks, who was the partner of Frederick Law Olmsted, had a park there until 1920. And then it disappeared with construction of the Holland Tunnel, the West Side Highway. I restored that park there. The grass grew from asphalt, and you could see an 1880s design park here right in Lower Manhattan. So whenever we do something like that, in the city of Windsor, Ontario, they needed to build a highway, but how do you build a highway without destroying the fabric of a city, without creating the other side of the tracks or the other side of the highway and keep communities going? Or how to do it, we went back to the 1860s and looked how Frederick Law Olmsted built Central Park, which almost every New Yorker and every visitor will say that's a continuous park from 59th Street to 110th Street, when in fact it's five separate pods connected by bridges, which are masked because they look like the park, the tree line. So we did the same thing in the city of Windsor, Ontario, right opposite Detroit. And we built a roadway there that allows for the community to thrive on both sides of the highway. The highway isn't as intrusive and allows people to bike from end to end and to use some of the amenities just like Olmsted would have designed.
Kind of what I'm taking out of that is, as important as the data is in what we do, the conversations with the users, you had to understand that they forgot how to commute, essentially. They forgot how to get out of their car. And it just speaks, I think, to our projects, is that there's a people component of them, and you can't forget that. I mean, we need to do our calculations, we need to check data, make smart decisions, but we need to understand the user.
Exactly, and it's a mistake. We traffic engineers, highway engineers, transportation planners, and engineers made a terrible mistake in the 20th century. There's a very good book called Fighting Traffic by Peter Norton, a wonderful book about the period from 1900 to 1930. 1900, pedestrians ruled the streets. Bike riders were actually the colleagues, were here before the cars and became the colleagues of the cars for the hard road movement. And people walked any which way they wanted. And along came the automobile. And we focused not on the people. There were far more people in the cities.
Right.
We focused on the vehicles. And then we embarked upon a century, and it continues in many places today, a century of how to move vehicles faster, not thinking about maybe we're going to move overall people slower, but we're moving vehicles faster. And this is my next book, No One at the Wheel, is also the same fear. We're going to figure out how to move autonomous vehicles faster, closer together, and we're going to forget that the real goal is people. And autonomous vehicles, back in the 1930s, Le Corbusier and other modernists said the problem is the pedestrian. We can move cars very fast if we get rid of the pedestrians, so let's put pedestrians at a different level. Same thing is happening with autonomous vehicles right now. Researchers are realizing pedestrians, we, people, are the problem. They could solve every vehicular problem. Vehicles could talk to each other. They could talk to the infrastructure, but they can't talk as well to pedestrians or bike riders. And some researchers have gotten as silly as all of us will have to be wearing badges that say we're pedestrians or bike riders, and it'll be a criminal offense if we don't do that. That sounds ridiculous. But imagine today we travel back in time to 1900 and we tell pedestrians, you know what, if you walk the way you're walking right now, diagonally across the street, mid-block, that then you're not hugging the building, that's a crime. We're going to throw you in jail. We tell that person in 1900, we're going to shine a light in your face. You've been walking as a biped for 30 million years. We're now going to shine a light in your face and you have to stop. And if you don't stop, we're going to throw you in jail. It's a criminal offense. That's how ridiculous it would have been to a person in 1900. I fear the same thing is going to happen to us by 2030. They're going to realize the problem is not the vehicles. The vehicles do just fine. It's those pesky human beings that get in the way.
Your book is forthcoming.
My book will be out this fall, No One at the Wheel, and published by Public Affairs. And it separates the hype, you know, from the reality. AVs are coming. I'm a big believer in AVs. Some of our clients are AV makers. It's not that I'm against AVs, but we have to do it the right way. So the working title of the book until the publisher picked the title was Driverless Cars, The Good, The Bad, The Ugly. The good is if we do it right. The bad and ugly is we do it wrong. And again, we forget about human beings and let vehicles take over.
All right, Sam, just to bring us full circle, we've gone through your career. In 1995, you decided to start this company, Sam Schwartz, I think with a staff of a couple of people. And that was, I guess, because you had gone through your career and then you wanted to start something and help and continue to do what you love doing. Is that right?
Yes. Well, you know, I thought I would die with my boots on as a government worker, but mayors have a way of getting their own new team. So once that happened, I did work briefly for another consulting company and then thought, gee, what if I went out on my own and made a living? I was not even thinking of building a company other than a few people. And the company grew, and it grew kind of rapidly, and particularly in the New York metropolitan area. People knew who I was. I certainly, being Gridlock Sam, helps. Yeah. Many people want to go to the doctor who is cited in some magazine article. That's the doctor I want. The same thing. I was the guy that people would see on TV. People would see in the newspaper, say, I want that guy. But that only carries you so far. you then need a team and you need to deliver to your clients. And so we began to grow, and we started out mostly as a private sector firm. If you're not a set-aside firm, it's very hard in a market like New York to get government work, because the small government work goes to the minority, the women-owned businesses, the disadvantaged businesses. And I'm a big believer in diversity, so I don't argue the point, but it's very hard if you're not a set-aside firm to do government work. So I didn't do government work, except here and there. I did private sector work. I did a little opposition work that I wasn't crazy about. And ultimately, I reached a size of about 50 people. And that's when I thought maybe I could start to compete on the government stage. And it was a good thing I did, because the year was 2007 when I decided, let's go after government work. 2008 was the crash. I had decided to open offices in other cities prior to the crash. And turns out that we, through the recession, the Great Recession, we doubled our revenue but halved our profit, because we went from private sector, very profitable work, to government work, not very profitable and torturous to fill out some of the government invoices, to suffer from audits, to the paperwork, the number of people you have to hire, whereas the private sector, it's so much easier. So fortunately, the private sector dried up during the recession. I had government work, and now the firm is about a 60-40 public-private. And the firm split into two in 2014. What happened was, as I mentioned earlier, I had a traffic enforcement background, and we had a lot of clients who could use police services. And we became a registered vendor for the New York City Police Department, because we had some former NYPD from the NYPD Traffic Division working for us. And so we started to provide police officers at job sites, sometimes to move the traffic, sometimes to protect the job site, sometimes to get better stipulations from the city on some things. And doing that for 10 years, some of the cops retired and said, let's try to make a business of this. So we created a title called Pedestrian Traffic Management Services, and the company grew. And in 2014, that other company began to operate in 10 states. Now about 15 states they're operating. So we split the company because it really was different. So there's 125 people that are doing planning and engineering, and we're growing. And then the other work is kind of seasonal. So at any given time, we may have 30 or 40, but during the holiday season, we're up to 300 to 400 people.
You know, I was preparing for this interview, looking at like your career and what you've accomplished and talking to you here. It's interesting because it seems like if someone were to come to me and say, you know, I want to be someone who's a transportation engineer, planner, I want to build a company, how should I go about doing it? I kind of would probably say a lot of the stuff that you've done, which is basically made a name for yourself. You worked initially with a government job, learning the systems and the processes. You start out in the field, and then you really built up your expertise with Gridlock Sam and your books, and then you came into this company, you're building it, and which is amazing, but it sounds like it wasn't all that straightforward, and there was a lot of thinking it out, a lot of conversations that led you to these different steps in your career. So it's interesting to look at it as one body of work, knowing that there was a lot that went into it, a lot of turns, a lot of twists. As you grow this company now, what does the future hold for you and this company? What are your goals?
I am now 70 years old, a young 70-year-old, still play a couple of hours of tennis a week and and bike ride, but I know age means something at some point. And so I now have an investor in the company, and it's a Spanish firm out of Barcelona, GPO, and they don't want to change the firm at all. And I've managed to work out what I think is a sweetheart deal for me, because not only do I remain CEO for as many years as I want, but also I stay majority owner for a number of years. So they're slowly acquiring the company. One of the things that I didn't want to do, which I've seen a lot of my colleagues do, is they reach 65, 70 years old. They realize they want to get their equity out of the company. They sell the company outright and then have to work for the company for 3 years. They watch the identity of the company go from whatever their company was to XYZ Consultants. And there's a whole new culture. Mm-hmm. And it's very painful of what other people have told me. And to see the people that were the most loyal to them, some of them may not be viewed by new management as being terribly useful or maybe even disloyal. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to maintain control. And I wasn't sure I'd be able to find a company that would invest in me on a part-time, only owning part of the firm, and not the majority of the firm, but over time, ultimately owning a majority of the firm, but not changing the nature of the firm. So the GPO's intention is not to change the name, not to change what we do, the kinds of work that we do. Certainly gives us a lot of expansion because they do a lot of heavy rail work around the world, but we have exclusive rights to New York, the United States, to Canada, and we do some work internationally. For me, it's been a dream. I continue as CEO for many, many years. They've guaranteed that. In fact, more years than I'd like necessarily. So the argument is they want me to be CEO longer, and I haven't committed yet to it. But in any event, I still am majority owner. Majority owner for another few years. And that makes the transition a lot less painful because they get to know who really are the valuable people in the company. They see it through my eyes. And it's not one day you're Sam Schwartz Engineering, and the next day you're XYZ Consulting, and now we're going to tear down all the Sam Schwartz signs. We're going to come up with the culture of the XYZ company. Our culture is a very unique culture. People want to work here. I call us like the Ivy League of consulting, because people fight for positions here, and people are very picky. My staff is far pickier than I am. I really am not involved in the hiring process anymore. But people want to work here because of the imaginative work that we do, because of the cutting edge, because of the people that they associate with in the company. And we're seeing wonderful things happen. Chicago, we've doubled the staff in Chicago. We're busy in Florida. We're doing next generation transportation on the West Coast. With a smaller company, you can make decisions more quickly. Somebody comes up with an idea that we like. Let's go work on smart cities. Okay, let's work on smart cities. There is no bureaucracy here. We say, if you make it successful, it's yours. You own it, take it wherever you want to go.
That's great. Yeah, it really is. And if you go to samschwartz.com, I went to the website and you have a great video on your about page. And it's called Making the Journey Better. And it's all Sam's employees talking about why they love doing what they do. Really, they're literally making the journey better for people, pedestrians, traffic every day. And it's great. So what we're going to do now is, I don't want to keep Sam much longer. He's very busy, but we're going to finish off here with a couple of rapid fire questions that we call our hot seat. They're very simple, Sam. You'll be great at them. I can tell already. Okay. And we'll finish this up.
Civil Engineering Podcast.
Civil Engineering Podcast.
I hope you're enjoying the interview with Sam Schwartz. Now it's time for me to put Sam on the CE hot seat. However, before I do that, I do want to take a moment to recognize our sponsor for the episode, PPI. I have some big news for my civil engineering listeners. If you've been thinking of getting your PE license, but you're unsure of where to start, now is the perfect time to check out PPI2Pass.com. PPI has helped over 4 million engineers pass their licensure exam and become leaders in their fields. Best of all, PPI has recently released the brand new Civil Engineering Reference Manual, the essential book for your PE civil exam prep. Visit PPI2Pass.com to order the new Civil Engineering Reference Manual and take one step closer to career advancement. That's PPI2Pass.com. I also have a 20% off promo code available for listeners of this podcast. Use promo code TCE8 on PPI's website for an exclusive 20% discount. Again, that's the promo code TCE, like the civil engineer, TCE and the number 8.
All right, Sam, first question here. Are there any specific rituals or routines that you practice every day? For example, do you have a specific morning routine or lunchtime, something that you do consistently that contributes to your success?
I think it's waking up, checking those emails, not letting anything slide. If I send somebody an email and I don't think they're responsive enough, I might even send a copy to myself the next day. So I am very vigilant on a 24-hour process. A client asks us for something. If it's a private client, in 24 hours later, they may even have a proposal. So my ritual is the 24-hour rule. You get back to people, get back to them quickly. If you can't do it in 24 hours, you let them know.
All right, next one, Sam. What is one book that you recommend to engineers regularly, or just one book that you found to be extremely helpful in your professional or personal development?
It's funny, people say to me, engineering students, what should I be studying? And what I tell them, and they're kind of surprised, I said, take a theater course. Take certainly a speaking course, but get out of your shell. Engineers are very good at staying in shells, and now with social media, in many ways, we're too much in our shells.
Yeah.
So maybe The Art of the Theater might be the best book for them to read about how to communicate to people. If you're an engineer and you want to be a cog, and there's nothing wrong with that, and you want to spend 40 years doing calculations, and that's what you really enjoy, great. But if you want to move up in an engineering organization, you've got to be able to sell. Those are the ones that can dictate their own future. They could find the kinds of markets that they want to work in. They could land those kinds of jobs. How do you land those jobs? You convince people you're the best for that job. That person has to take money out of their pocket and give it to you. You have to give them something in return, and they have to have the confidence that you will give them something that is of value to them. You don't learn that in engineering school. You don't learn those kinds of communications. Where do you learn how to present? Where do you learn how to act? Well, in acting school. So I would say take some theater courses. The Art of Theater would be a very good book.
All right, Sam, I've got one final question, which we call this civil engineering career elevator advice question. So if you got into an elevator with a young engineer and they said, Sam, starting out, give me some advice in the next 30 seconds before we get off the elevator on what I should do to be successful in this field, what would you say?
Know where the money is. Know who's hiring your firm or engineers. Learn how to speak their language. Learn to make commitments. Learn to sell, become an entrepreneur.
Excellent. All right, Sam Schwartz, thank you for spending time with us on the Civil Engineering Podcast. You can find Sam at samschwartz.com. There's also gridlocksam.com. And his book will be coming out very soon on driverless cars, which he talked about. And we're going to be sure to share that with you as well. Thanks so much, Sam.
You're quite welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Sam Schwartz as much as I did. It was really nice to actually go and sit down with him, and I'm going to be doing that for some more episodes of this podcast, trying to visit with successful civil engineers in their offices and just engage with them. I think it's good to change it up a little bit and do that and have some face-to-face interviews, so I'll sprinkle them in. And if you ever have ideas for guests, please let me know. Also, before we close this one out, I do want to remind you that if you're a civil engineering professional and you want to become a manager or you want to improve your managerial and leadership skills, please check out our Engineering Management Accelerator online workshop. It's a 5-week program that will help you improve your engineering management skills. And I'm not going to tell you all about the curriculum. You could find all that at engineer2manager.com. But what I do want to do is we've been following up with people that have gone through the course over the last year. And I want to read a short email back from one of the participants. And it goes like this. Hi, Anthony. Yes, I have noticed that since I completed the EMA workshop, I have been able to better align my priorities and not try to do everything the same day. I have started planning my day and focusing on important things. I utilize the techniques mentioned in the workshop to help meet my goals and manage projects as well as people better. I should say that my networking skills at BD events have improved as well, as I'm able to approach people that I don't know and start a conversation. Just think about that. Think about all the things in that one paragraph that I just read that if you could apply or those things could happen to you, how they will transform your engineering career. So please go to engineer2manager.com. That's engineer2manager.com and join us for the next session. It starts June 1st. You got about a week left to sign up, and we will get you in and get you going and help you become a more effective engineering manager. Please remember you can find the show notes for this interview with Sam Schwartz at civilengineeringpodcast.com. Look for episode number 85. You'll find a summary of the key points discussed in today's episode, as well as links to any of the resources, websites, or books mentioned during the episode. Until next time, I wish you the best in all of your civil engineering career endeavors.
Thank you for listening to the Civil Engineering Podcast. Be sure to visit civilengineeringpodcast.com, where you can listen to past episodes and also submit your project to be featured on the show. We also invite you to visit our main website at engineeringcareercoach.com and download a free 3-part video series created specifically for engineers to help you best utilize LinkedIn for networking, improve your communication and speaking skills, and also help to develop your leadership abilities. Now is the time to engineer your own success.